From 9to5Mac, this is Stacktrace, a podcast where we talk about Apple news and rumors from a developer's perspective. I am John Sandell, and I'm joined, like always, by my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Guy?
I'm doing great, enjoying my semi-indie life.
That's awesome. The half-indie life is really exciting, and I'm looking forward to seeing what's going to come out of that for you.
Oh yeah, I've even been waking up earlier than usual just to enjoy the most of my day.
Nice. Yeah, it's funny because for me it works kind of similarly. Like if I am working on something on my own that I'm like super motivated by, like, you know, I can't wait to get to work on it, I always wake up super early and I have a way, way easier time just to kind of get out of the bed in the morning, which is usually kind of a big endeavor for me. So yeah, that's one big benefit of working on your own stuff, I guess, is that, you know, since you set your own agenda and since you work on things that, you know, you've come up with yourself, you know, it's usually easier to motivate yourself to get out of the bed in the morning.
Yeah, for me, it's not just an excitement type of thing. It's also that it's all on me, at least the stuff I'm working on right now. So if I am awake and able to code, I can do anything. But like for company stuff, I depend on other people and they wake up a little bit later. So there's no point in waking up super early unless I want to like answer emails and stuff. So yeah, working by yourself has that advantage that you only depend on yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also kind of a little bit of a responsibility thing. At least that's how I feel. Like, you know, since I am, it kind of ties into what you said, where I am the only person who, you know, is moving this thing forward, or, you know, I am the main person who does that, even though I cooperate with other people like you and, you know, others for other projects. It gives me another kind of sense of responsibility when it comes to planning, like we talked on the last episode, and, you know, just structuring things and making sure that things move forward.
Yes, and speaking of indie and waking up early, what have you been doing lately?
So I've been waking up early, and I've been working a lot on my book lately, on planning out all the content. Like, I've been doing a lot of pre-production the last couple of months, but also getting into actual writing. I've been writing quite a lot, and also just structuring the book itself. Like, you know, the difference between doing what I've been doing for the last couple of years, which is, you know, writing separate articles and now writing a book, is that I want the whole book to kind of have a narrative through it, and I want you to be able to read it from cover to cover and, you know, kind of just get the sense for, you know, what I'm trying to say in terms of like how these different concepts and techniques and chapters relate to each other. So I've been working on that, which has been a lot of fun. I still don't have like an estimate release date for the book, but I am targeting sometime like mid this year, you know, at least for starting to get it out. But we'll see. Like, I'm going to know more as I get further, like exactly how long I think this project is going to take. But since this is my first book that I'm working on, which is based on the content from my website, but I'm rewriting everything from scratch in book format, even though I'm reusing some sample code, I'm obviously writing about similar concepts and things, but, you know, more bigger picture. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's challenging. But we're going to see how it's going to go.
Exciting. I want a signed copy, please.
Sure, we can make that happen. And I've also been doing a pretty special episode of my other show, Swift by Sundell, which I did together with Apple, actually.
The entirety of Apple?
not everyone. Not all the employees weren't on the episode. No, I did it with Ted Kremenek, who's the head of the languages and runtimes team at Apple. And by the time this episode comes out, that episode will also be out. So we'll put a link to it in the show notes. But that was a lot of fun to do. And I've obviously been putting in, you know, a little bit of extra effort into that episode, into the editing and everything, just to make sure it's like really, really nice. Because, you know, it's not every day that you have, you know, an executive from Apple on the show. So that's been a lot of fun to do as well.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you more about this episode after it goes out, because I think there's an interesting process that goes into making an episode like that, which I think we should discuss later when it's out.
Yeah, that'll be fun. So what about you? What have you been up to?
So I've been doing lots of Chibi Studio stuff and AirBuddy as well, working on it. Got the iPhone XR icon to display correctly in the widget. The update is not out yet. I'm working on lots of things for this update, so please be patient, my users, but there will be an update soon-ish. Sooner than AirPower. That joke never gets old.
No, that could be the tagline for your app, right?
Yeah, and I told you last week about the death of my iPhone XS Max, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. Yeah. We almost held a little funeral for it, you know, lit a candle, sang a little song. So how's that been going?
Yeah, so it's back to life.
Oh, yeah. It's yes. Undead.
Yes, the undead iPhone. So
nice.
I don't know what happened. I can speculate as to what happened, but here is the story. So I was at the office and I used my iPhone to get an Uber to go have lunch at a mall with my colleague. And then I used it to call an Uber to go back to the office. And then I put it in my pocket. That's all regular iPhone usage. Then a few minutes later, I wanted to check something on my iPhone. And I took it out of my pocket and the screen didn't light up. That was weird. Like,
yeah.
That there's the little accelerometer thing and it never fails for me. So I tapped the screen and nothing happened. So I held the power button and nothing happened. I plugged it into my Mac and nothing happened. I then started to panic and tried to enable DFU mode and nothing happened. So yeah, so my iPhone XS Max was declared dead at that exact time.
Yeah,
and
flatlined.
Flatlined. So I called a friend who's got an authorized repair center here, and he told me, yeah, that happens, but why don't you leave it alone for like until tomorrow and then plug it into the iPad charger and wait and see what happens. And so, yeah, I did exactly that. I didn't use it anymore. I moved my SIM card to my iPhone XR, which it's mostly a test device, but it has my iCloud account and stuff. So I used that for a while. And the next day, I woke up and I plugged my iPhone XS Max into the iPad charger and it turned on.
Hooray! Came back to life. Maybe just needed like a little bit of a timeout, a little bit of rest.
Yeah. It was tired of me.
Yeah.
So what I think happened, I don't know for sure, but I think something in that device was basically stuck in an infinite loop. Like maybe the baseband chip was stuck, maybe the secure enclave, maybe the main processor, but I think that would be able to be solved by holding down the power button.
Right.
But what I think happened is that it entered an infinite loop in some way.
In the firmware, and, like somewhere really low level, yeah.
And when the battery died, because it wasn't hot or anything, it didn't really do anything. So when the battery eventually died, it then reset itself.
Yeah.
So that's my theory. I think it makes sense. As soon as it came back to life, I took a sysdiagnos and sent it to Apple as a radar. I don't think that's going to do anything, but hey, might as well.
Yeah,
it's running the
good
beta.
Good citizenship, right?
Yeah, it is running the beta, so it could be some issue with the beta. Yeah, so that's what happened, and it was an interesting story. Yeah, I'm happy it's back to life and hasn't died again yet.
Yeah, me too. I'm happy for you that your XS Max is back. And this was one of the times where having an iPhone purchasing addiction is actually a good thing, right? Because you had the XR, which you know most people would consider a super great phone, right? And even though it's a slight downgrade, I guess, from the XS Max that you usually use, you know, that was great that you had that one so you could actually use that as your main phone.
Yep. So another little thing I want to mention, and a little bit of a rant, is that I hate badges on iOS. You know, the little numbers that show up on icons?
Yeah.
I hate those. And I want Apple to implement a feature that allows you to turn them off for the entire system.
All right. Because I was just going to tell you the line that you usually tell me when I complain about something, which is, you know, you can turn it off, right?
Yeah, so I always turn them off. As soon as an app throws a badge on its icon, I turn it off in settings, but you have to do it for each app.
Right, yeah, so you won't be able to do system-wide.
Yeah, I wanted to, because I never want that. That's super distracting and it makes me anxious. So, yeah, I don't want badges. And many apps, and I would say most apps that use badges, don't know how to invalidate the badges correctly. So, you launch the app again, and the badge will still be there, even after you've opened the app. Or they put badges in the icon for no reason whatsoever. Yeah, I want badges to die.
Wow. Yeah, I think that it can be really hard also as a developer to decide when it's appropriate to display a badge.
The answer is never.
But I still think that for a lot of people, like, I kind of like badges when they are relevant. So as a concrete example, for Mail, the Mail app, I have badges turned on only for my business email account. So I have a couple of different email accounts, and one I mostly use for like all my private stuff and for things that I, you know, sign up to, like accounts, and when I book a hotel or something like that, that all goes to my private email account. But then I have a business email account, which I use to, you know, talk to customers and sponsors and all that kind of stuff. And that I have badges enabled for. And that's really valuable to me because then I can immediately see on my home screen that I have an important email that I need to take a look at, while all the other emails, you know, don't really need that. But that's a level of granularity that I can use, and it works out for that app. But then in other applications, it can, to your point, kind of get a little bit frustrating sometimes. And I would argue, for example, I know that we've been bashing Slack a lot on the show for various reasons. And, you know, I'm definitely, I really do like Slack, actually. I just want to say that. Like, I think Slack is pretty awesome, you know, regardless of all the Electron stuff. But the default setting for badges in Slack is something that I always change, because the default is to always show a badge whenever there is any new message in any channel. And that's too aggressive for me. So I don't dislike badges, but I do like when an app offers more, like a more level of control, like higher granularity. And I also like when they are more used for like really important stuff rather than just saying, hey, there's some new content in this app.
Yeah, now that you mention it, maybe the setting should be like, leave badges off by default, and then you opt into badges in the apps that you really want them to appear.
Yeah. I think also badges was like super useful in the early days of the iPhone, and it's one of those things that's been there since forever, because, yep, you know, apps weren't as like continuously updated in the background, so it was good to know before you launched an app, which took longer also, to know that there's some content there. So yeah, I can kind of see the value of them, but I can also see your point where, you know, some middle ground is probably to be found somewhere where they're not overly used and they're also not completely banned.
Yeah.
All right. So speaking about iOS, we want to follow up on our cliffhanger from the last episode. So on previously on Stacktrace, we talked about iOS and we talked about the new rumors and reports from people like Mark Gurman saying that iOS 13 will have a significant overhaul when it comes to iPad features. And you've also done a little bit of digging around this, I know, and you've been looking at stuff, and it looks like there is an indication that Springboard itself, like the main Springboard that runs the home screen and all kind of associated processes on iOS, is kind of going away on the iPad for iOS 13. Is that a good way of describing it, Rambo?
Yes, so the people have spoken to me. what I believe is going to happen is either Springboard on iPad is going away completely and it's going to be replaced by another something board.
Padboard.
Yeah, whatever. Or I happen to know a name that it could be, but I'm not sure if it is that, so I'm going to keep it a secret for now. Or it's going to be something on top of Springboard, like Springboard is still going to be there as like the main shell, but the UI you actually see and interact with is going to be a new thing. Kind of like on Apple TV, they have like two boards that are kind of intermingled. But that means, regardless of the technical implementation details, it means that the home screen on iPad is going to change significantly.
That is good news, because that's, I think, something that has pretty much been a source of debate since the original iPad. That, you know, when the original iPad was announced, some people like to joke that it's just like one big iPod Touch. And in many ways, like the current home screen UI on the iPad is kind of like one big iPod Touch or one big iPhone, like just a grid of icons. So what do you think about this? Like, do you think that Apple is like departing from just showing a grid of icons? They're doing something completely different, or what do you think?
Yeah, you know what I would like to happen, and I think is a possibility, not to completely ditch the icon stuff, but like, let's say when you close an app, instead of it basically minimizing itself into its home screen icon, it becomes a little widget in your home screen. And that's going to be like a view controller from the app that's going to show you the most important stuff about the app that you might want to see. And when you open it, it like grows from this widget into the full app UI or something like that. Kind of like complications in a way, or you can call them widgets. Also like the little Siri suggestion stuff that Apple likes, maybe that could be a part of it. Maybe also integrated search without you having to do any gesture or open a special UI for searching. Those are the types of things I think they would do for this new home screen.
Yeah, I want to dive into all of those things in more depth. But before we do that, I wanted to ask you, I think this is something that we talked a little bit about with Rene Ritchie when he was on the show, and that is kind of a reason why I think that this grid of icons has survived as long as it has on the iPad, and that's because of this muscle memory. Like when Rene was on, we talked about like when you have a box which has like Siri suggestions or something that is like algorithmically driven and that changes all the time, you kind of lose your muscle memory. You can't just flick open a screen and press one button. And I think like everyone listening to the show probably like knows their home screens, especially like the first one, kind of inside out. Like you could probably launch any app on your first home screen while blindfolded, right? Yeah. So my question to you would be like, do you think there's a risk that if the home screen becomes this like super dynamic thing that can change and, you know, things can grow and take different place depending on the time of day or how relevant they are deemed by the system, do you think there's a risk that we kind of lose the simplicity of being able to use our muscle memory to like access apps?
Yeah, totally. But I don't believe they would apply this Siri knowledge stuff to the entire home screen. I believe it would be just like an area in the home screen, just like we have an area in Spotlight right now for Siri suggestions. I think it would be like a specific area of the home screen, like at the top or at the side, I don't know.
Right, so every day wouldn't be the home screen shuffle. It's time for the daily home screen shuffle.
Yeah, that would be kind of crazy. Yeah. So what I think also is that the concept of icons wouldn't die. There's Launchpad on the Mac. Remember that?
Remember Launchpad? Yeah.
So they could add an icon to the dock or some other place, I don't know, or some gesture, whatever, some keyboard shortcut even, that summons this legacy icon grid that's on top of your home screen. And there you have all of your icons arranged in the same way as the home screen is today, and that you can customize and of course search for apps. So I think it's not that the grid of icons is going to die, it's not going to be the default.
All right. That sounds very much like how things work on Android as well, where on an Android home screen, I mean, there are many different flavors of this depending on the vendor of the device, because they all apply their own kind of UI style on top of vanilla Android. But the way it generally works is that you have a home screen which can contain widgets, just like you mentioned. It can contain suggestions and things like that, and, you know, Google Assistant things. But then you have this button to open up like a list of all your apps, which is pretty much what you're saying here as well. And, you know, I think that's been working pretty well for Android. But I'm also thinking in terms of just simplicity and how I at least think that Apple would like to solve something like this in terms of design is not to have like that separate list of like a legacy mode or something, but rather to have it all integrated. So the way I'm kind of thinking about it is, how about that we keep the grid, right? We have the grid still, but you could say that this app does not only occupy one slot on the grid, it occupies two slots or four slots or something else. And that way you could change it yourself. And it kind of ties back into this whole idea of an app being completely responsive, like we talked about before, where you can take an app and it can run full screen on the iPad. You can scale it down to run on this very thin and narrow side of the screen. But imagine taking that one step further and saying, what if you could scale it all the way down to be only like two icons on the home screen wide? And that would make the app be able to run in like a little widget mode. But then you could like drag it out and say, no, actually, today I am going to do a lot of work in reminders. So I'm just going to take reminders and just drag it out to be like one quarter of the screen here on the home screen. And it's just going to render itself, like the app itself, on the home screen like that. What do you think about that? I think that could be, both from a kind of a technical and design perspective, it could be pretty elegant, like just from a kind of, concept perspective. But I think it also could be incredibly useful and quite intuitive to just say, you know, here's an app you can interact with however you want. You can just drag it out on the home screen. You can launch it. You can drag it out to be side by side in full screen mode, etc. What do you think about that?
From a user perspective, I think it's great. From a technical perspective, I think it's overloading the app even more.
Right.
Like, we've complained on this show before how much the iOS app model and especially the app delegate is overloaded with lots of things that maybe should be separate processes, like doing background work. So I would really prefer the home screen app UI to be an extension instead of overload the app even more and having to handle yet another UI variation inside the same app. But yeah, if they could come up with a solution that wouldn't be too crazy for developers, I think that would be welcome. And I also think that the home screen won't be just apps. The shelf concept that I think Vitici made in his, I think it was an iOS 11 concept.
Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes to it. It's pretty cool, like the way you could drag things over into a shelf to kind of save them in your clipboard, if you will.
Yeah, I believe this would be really cool, like to have this concept of a shell. And maybe they could go even further and unify this concept of a shell with the concept of a clipboard manager. So and sync that across all of your devices. There are third-party solutions for that. I use Paste to sync my clipboard across devices, and it's amazing to be able to, I copied this picture 2 hours ago on my Mac and be able to get it on my iPhone. Having that native by Apple would be amazing, and be able to like drag files into the home screen and add them to this shelf thing that syncs across devices. I think that would be amazing. And another thing, on the Mac, when you use Siri, you can drag the result from a Siri query into Notification Center and it will stay there. Why can't you do that on iPad? Like,
right,
drag
yeah.
a Siri result, like, show me the stock value for Apple Inc. And then you could just drag that stock widget to your home screen and have it there. That would be amazing as well.
Yeah, it almost ties back a little bit to dashboard, right? Where you could open Safari and you could say, clip out this rectangle from this website and keep that up to date as a widget. And that's how, I think I mentioned it before, but you know, when I was in high school, that's how I got like tram times and public transport times as a widget on my Mac, while there was no app or anything like that from like the Swedish public transport company in my city.
That's how I used to track packages.
Oh yeah, that's really smart. So yeah, those are all like super cool ideas, and I think there's definitely something to be said for unifying things, and it feels a little bit like how Apple is moving, like in many ways, where, you know, with Marzipan, like we talked about on last episode, and, you know, with unification of some of these fundamental technologies, and Siri is definitely an area where you would like more unification, where, you know, as I'm starting to use Siri more and more, you would like it to behave, you know, like it does on iOS or on the Mac, but you want it to be the same everywhere, like even on tvOS or even in the car, etc. Because once you get used to it, not being able to like create a reminder while you're in the car, it kind of feels, it breaks the illusion a little bit. It breaks the illusion that you have this smart, intelligent assistant with you at all times, which, you know, when Siri works and you use it that way, like I've been doing for the last couple of weeks, it's really cool. And it makes you feel like you have this real virtual assistant you can talk to. Maybe that's a sign that I'm going a little bit crazy. I don't know. But anyway, I would love for things to be more unified.
Yeah, this is not directly related to new home screen stuff, but you know what I feel like Apple should really focus on, and like go and talk to third-party developers and like ask them to implement this stuff and make it better, is media handoff. Like, why can't I in 2019 be watching a video on YouTube on my iPhone and just hand off to my Apple TV? I don't want to use AirPlay. I want to play it on my Apple TV. Why can't I do that?
Yeah, you should be able to use Siri for it too, right? You should be able to say, hey, Dingus, transfer this movie from my phone to my TV.
Yep, yeah, but like we have handoff. Handoff is a thing. It works. But of course, third parties need to implement it, and YouTube hasn't. But there's no handoff on Apple TV. You can't use it on Apple TV. There's no API for it. There's no system UI for it. Another thing that's missing from Apple TV, which is kind of crazy, there's no picture-in-picture on Apple TV.
Yeah, I think like unification in general, or making the experience more consistent across platforms, is something we're going to see more and more. And I think it does actually relate to the new home screen on iPad, because, you know, like you mentioned, being able to like use a result of a query, or maybe use a part of a website, or maybe just, you know, take something from your desktop on the Mac, you know, the way you can arrange things and move that onto the iPad, maybe putting a file on your home screen. You know, there are so many of these different things you can think of that could maybe be viewed as edge cases, but for certain workflows, it can be a huge boost in productivity. Again, imagine you're working on a specific task for the entire day. You know, let's say I'm working on my book. Maybe I could dedicate a home screen to like all the different files I have, maybe like put apps bigger, like I mentioned earlier, to be able to really, you know, use that home screen as my base of operations as I'm working on this project. So I definitely think it ties into it. And I think being able to hand things off between devices in a more smooth manner is going to be really key in order to, you know, have that really high level of productivity where you can use the Mac for everything that it's great for, use the iPad for everything it's great for, and iPhone, etc. So, yeah, I think that would be really cool to see.
I also want picture-in-picture on iPhone.
You want picture-in-pictures everywhere.
Picture-in-picture all the things.
Do you want this Android mode where you can run like four apps at the same time, you know, in split screen on the iPhone?
Yeah, maybe not that. But like the picture-in-picture on iPhone thing is crazy, because it's a bit that they need to flip, and that's it. Like,
right.
I've made it work on my jailbroken iPhone 5S, and it works flawlessly. Why can't I have it on my XS Max, which has a huge screen and a super powerful processor? I mean, it's like, just, yeah, if you want picture-in-picture, buy an iPad.
Yeah, maybe that's why. That's the selling point. So the final thing that I want to talk about regarding the iPad and iOS 13 is a little bit around keyboards, and specifically how iOS supports keyboard and keyboard shortcuts.
Or how it doesn't.
Right. So the last couple of weeks, I've been doing some experiments around this, and basically I was looking for a way to add keyboard controls to a game. So the backstory is that I was playing the port of Final Fantasy VII, which is one of my favorite games of all time, on the iPad during my recent trip. And when I came home and I was like, oh, maybe I should pick up this game again, I had the iPad on my desk with the keyboard, and I thought to myself, why can't I just control this with a keyboard? You know, it would be perfect. And it turns out that there's almost no games that I know of. There's like Civilization, you could scroll the map with the arrow keys, but that was about it. That's all I found. So I thought to myself, how come this is not more widely supported? You know, isn't there already an API for this? And there is a API called UI Key Command in iOS. And to praise Apple a little bit, that API is, I think, super nice. Like, it's so simple. The way it works is that the first responder, which will be like the current view controller, it can return an array of UI key commands. And those UI key commands are just a target and an action to be run when a given key command, like a combination of keys, is pressed. And it's super easy to define. So you can say, when the user presses Command N within this screen, you should create a new document. Or when the user presses Command Z in this screen, you should do undo. The problem is that that's all it supports. So it's very, very elegant and nice and simple for this specific use case, which is just keyboard shortcuts to perform a single task. But in a game, and also in some other use cases like in apps, you also want continuous events. So let's say you're building a platform game where your character can run back and forth and the character can jump. When you're running back and forth, you want to detect when is the user pressing this key and for how long, and when do they stop pressing this key? And this is not supported yet. So the way I hacked this, so Rambo, you should be proud of me because I did some spelunking.
Oh, nice.
So the spelunking I did was that I actually created a web view in the background. And because I remember from my JavaScript days, you know, when I was a JavaScript developer, that you get keyboard events like key up, key down, etc. in JavaScript. And I thought, maybe that's going to work in a web view. And it turns out it does. So yay. I was able, using a web view, to observe these events and to control my game character that way. So this was a big workaround. You know, I don't expect all apps to use this workaround. But I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this. Like, how do you feel about keyboard shortcuts being limited? And do you think that if keyboard shortcuts became more powerful on iOS, that would, you know, also enable the iPad to kind of take a leap forward?
I was just thinking that, like, oh, but I'm not writing games. That's not going to be useful to me. But then I was thinking how I wanted to add keyboard controls to the editor in Chibi Studio for you to be able to, like, use the arrows to move an item you have selected on screen and stuff like that.
Exactly, exactly. And imagine something like a Pixelmator or, you know, a PDF editor or something that you could move around, you know, the item that you have selected, or, you know, you do, you know, rotation or other things. You know, it can be really, really powerful.
Yeah, I was just seeing yesterday someone posted, I don't remember who it was, about a GitHub project that implements table view selection using the keyboard, which is also something that's not available. And that should be like by default, that should be implemented in UI table view. So you can like select stuff with your keyboard. Yeah, I think that should be available, period. And it's interesting that when Apple brings these things to iOS, they always like they go to the effort of exposing only like the super high level implementation of things that makes it work exactly how they want developers to implement the thing and with their design guidelines and stuff, which is good in a way because it leads to more consistent experience across apps from third parties, but it also has this problem that it limits the stuff you can do and the innovations you can come up with because the API is so limited.
Yeah, it is a bit of an interesting kind of design decision. And I think what you're alluding to a little bit there as well is that on the Mac, for example, maybe for historical reasons or, you know, APIs are a bit older or that the stack is a little bit different, but usually you can dive a little bit deeper. And that's also true for some iOS APIs that are a little bit older where, you know, you usually have the option of selecting your level in the stack that you want to work with. And I think one really good example of this that is extremely powerful even on iOS and on the Mac is graphics, like, you know, rendering UI, where if you want, or probably, you know, for most use cases, you probably should, just stick to the high-level APIs, you know, UIKit and Cocoa, you know, NSView, UIView, and render your UI that way. But then you can drop down to core animation, or you can drop down to core graphics, or you can drop down all the way down to metal. So you have these different levels of abstraction. You can choose the one that you need. And I think when implementing something like that, when Apple does that, I usually really love that. And I think that's one great strength of Apple's API design in general. And to your point, for something like keyboard shortcuts, I would also like to see like more like the underlying things being part of the API. And then, sure, provide a high-level API that makes it easy to do the right thing. But if you want to dive just one level deeper and customize something, that's always super nice to be able to do that without resulting to crazy hacks like, you know, running a web view with JavaScript in the background.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I really feel like we should start getting the training wheels removed from iOS and get more power to make better apps.
Yeah, especially with something like, you know, the iPad Pro, which does have a keyboard that many people use with it. It would be really great if you could build apps similar to as you would on the Mac with full keyboard support, because it's just such a huge productivity booster. You know, you mentioned being able to select rows in a table view using a keyboard. That'd be fantastic, you know, and that would be so nice when you are just working on the keyboard and you want to move around to be able to easily navigate. So I would love to see that more, like both built in out of the box, like as a high-level API, but also to give us access to more of the underlying events so that we can customize things if we need to.
Awesome.
Cool. So next up, let's switch gears a little bit, and we want to talk about foldable phones. So recently, there's been a bunch of news in the space, and I think this is a pretty exciting area. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's sponsor, which is once again our really good friends at Mac Stadium. So Mac Stadium, they're the leading provider of enterprise-class Mac infrastructure. They provide a scalable, reliable, and secure private clouds and dedicated servers for all of the workloads that you have that require macOS. So whether you need just a single Mac Mini, or if you need a fully scalable Mac private cloud, then Mac Stadium can help you move all of those workloads that you need to run on macOS from under your desk and into the cloud. You can just have a single Mac Mini with Mac Stadium that is dedicated to your workloads. Or you can also scale to thousands of Macs very easily, because they have over 8,000 Mac Minis currently racked in its data centers. You can work with experts to create your perfect cloud, and you'll be in really good company because there are so many really large customers that trust Mac Stadium for their needs. For example, Capital One, Box, Shopify, and Pandora, and many more, with over 3,000 customers worldwide. The benefits of using Mac Stadium for this type of work is that you can really reduce costs compared to do-it-yourself solutions, because you can get fixed monthly billing and really highly efficient infrastructure to work with your Mac Mini. So Rambo, you are currently renting a Mac Mini through Mac Stadium. So where is your Mac Mini located right now?
It's currently in Las Vegas. As we mentioned before, what happens in Vegas, you know?
Yeah, right.
But there's a cool surprise for our listeners. If you're listening in a podcast player that supports chapters, you can look at the chapter picture, and it's going to be a picture of the Mac Mini that's running my stuff on Mac Stadium. Yeah, the cool folks at Mac Stadium have provided me with the evidence that I do, in fact, have a Mac Mini at Mac Stadium. So if nice. You look at the chapter, you'll see the picture there. And it's currently running Sharecuts. It's also running the website, the landing page for Chibi Studio, my app. It's also running Splash, the little splash.rambo.codes page we made to highlight Swift code online. And also my blog, rambo.codes. So, and I'm planning on doing some continuous integration stuff with another Mac Mini soon. So it's awesome. It's really fun. I recommend it.
So how come you use a Mac for these kind of workflows instead of, I don't know, like spinning up some kind of serverless service, or using something like Linux or something like that instead for things like websites and hosting these services that you have, etc.?
In my case, I'm running the main service that's running in that Mac is Sharecuts. And it was designed from the beginning to be run on a Mac. It's a Swift on the server app. It's a Vapor app. But it depends on some things that are Mac specific. So that was a no-brainer, like to run it on Mac Stadium. And since it doesn't like use all the resources from the server, I can run other stuff at the same time without any issues.
Awesome. That's really cool. So if this sounds interesting to you, if you want to help us support this show, you should really check out Mac Stadium. The way you do that is you go to macstadium.com/stacktrace, because that'll show Mac Stadium that you came from this show, which really helps support our work. And you also get a special offer. And that special offer is that if you enter the promo code 9to5Mac when you order, then you're going to get 2 months for the price of one on a Mac Mini subscription, just like the one that Rambo has. So make sure to check them out. Again, that's macstadium.com/stacktrace and promo code 9to5Mac for 2 months for the price of one on a Mac Mini subscription. Thank you so much to Mac Stadium for sponsoring Stacktrace. All right, so foldable phones. This is something that kind of came up a little bit out of nowhere, it feels like, because it's been something that's been talked about for quite some time around like screen technology and the fact that, you know, certain screen manufacturers have been able to now start building screens that you can fold and they don't break. You know, that's actually not a bug, it's a feature. And that's been kind of, you know, just as an experiment or, you know, as a, just a demonstration of this technology. But now these things are starting to be unveiled as actual products. So two companies, as far as we know, at least, it could be even more, but as so far, both Samsung and Huawei unveiling foldable smartphones at the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona. So Samsung, they have their Galaxy Fold, which is a device that has kind of a small screen on the outside, but then you can fold it out, you can kind of open it up, and you have this big screen on the inside, kind of like a tablet. And then you've got the Huawei Mate X, or is it Huawei Mate 10? We don't know. which actually is interesting because it's the same kind of technology. It's also foldable, but it works kind of differently where instead you have the device itself, when it's folded, the folded screen kind of acts like two screens. So you have like a screen on the front and a screen on the back, and then you can fold it out and you then have one big screen instead. So I thought it was really interesting that we saw both of these companies unveil something like this, but the fact that the implementations are quite different also starts, you know, begging the question, like, what's the right approach? Is any of these approaches a right approach? So Rambo, what's your initial thought to seeing these two products being shown? Like, does any of them like look cool to you, or what do you think?
First, there's the technical side of things, which is really cool. Like the when you open, I only seen in action the Samsung one, so I won't talk too much about the Huawei one. But the way it opens and then the screen becomes one thing, even though it was folded, it looks like magic. It's like I don't know. It's stuff we see in science fiction movies from the 80s or something. That's super cool. But then there's the practical side of things. I really feel like, and I believe most people perceive it that way as well, that these are experiments. That they are like kind of like consumer prototypes, if you will.
Yeah.
As in, they're not quite sure yet what's the story behind this. Like, what's it for? What's it good for? What are the advantages? When you look at the Samsung one, when it's folded, it's not very appealing.
No, it looks a bit like a simulator running in the middle of a device. Like the screen is very, very small on the front, especially compared to the size of the device.
So I kind of feel like I wonder if it wouldn't be better for them to just go all in on the foldable aspect. And in the sense that this is something that's huge in terms of screen size, but you can still fit it in your pockets. and just don't have any screen on the outside, which would probably make them be able to do it thinner and stuff like that, maybe more visually appealing. I don't know, just wondering. But yeah, it's technically cool. It's practically not so done yet that we can say what the future is going to be like. It's funny that, I mean, we know that Apple has a foldable iPhone somewhere in Cupertino's
lab. In the garage, yeah.
Yeah.
In Johnny Ive's garage.
And what these other companies do is that they kind of do this development in the open. They as soon as they have something that's shippable, they go and ship it and see what happens. And it's different than the way Apple does things, which is to like get stuff in the lab and do lots and lots and lots of iterations until it's ready to be produced in a massive amount of units and be sold at Apple's prices. I'm not gonna say reasonable prices because you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, this costs like $2,000 or something like that. So
yeah,
that's like the price of a prototype. Like, I know prototypes are actually way more expensive, but like it is really expensive. So it's not like a mass market product.
Right.
It's like a super cool technical achievement product that people are going to have just to say like, hey, look at how cool this is. And I wish I had disposable income enough that I could get one because it is really cool.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the purpose as well. Like, there are a couple of different ways you can operate as a tech company, and Apple's way, like you say, is very much to take something, try to kind of really perfect it, like make it really, really good, and not try to be the first. They're almost never trying to be the first to any kind of product category, but then releasing something that just leapfrogs everyone else and, you know, makes a product that is much, much better and much more refined. And another strategy which these companies are taking is to kind of assert their kind of technical dominance in a way where they're saying, you know, we are so technically capable that we can produce this science fiction device, and that's amazing. And that kind of increases the way people look at a company like Samsung or Huawei, and maybe make people start thinking, well, the next time I'm buying a phone, maybe I'll get a Samsung phone because they look really technically advanced.
I bet if you could go into an Apple lab full of prototypes, you'd be like Nerd Disneyland or something.
Right,
because
exactly.
They must have some pretty cool stuff in there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I do think that they are very much kind of in the prototyping stage still, because the press wasn't even allowed to use these devices and not even touch them. And even I think Huawei didn't announce like release dates or prices or anything like that. So we're definitely early in the game, but I'm still really excited that this is starting to happen. And the question is like, what's the utility? And you started touching on that a little bit with like, you know, what kind of trade-offs do you make? Do you want to make like a big screen that is as thin as it can be? Or do you want to, you know, have two screens or something like that? And that's where I think it's very interesting to compare the approaches taken by both these two companies, where the Samsung one has pretty much like two different displays. Like, there's a small display on the outside, there's the big one on the inside. But the Huawei one, at least from the way it looks, it just has this one big single display that kind of wraps around the device. And depending on if it's folded or unfolded, it acts differently. And I just personally think that's like super fascinating, like that we now have technology like that, because in many ways, the way we're able to build and manufacture screens is so many times like a limiting factor to innovation. You know, when you watch science fiction, they always have these crazy screens that are, you know, see-through or holographic or foldable or super thin. And if we can move closer to that, I just feel like there's so much innovation that could happen where I also saw a couple of concepts where people were like, well, what if you would take a smartphone and that would also be a smartwatch? You just wrap it around your wrist, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many possibilities that open up. And I just think that this foldable screens technology, it might seem very gimmicky and the current implementation is certainly not perfect, but it's just incredibly exciting, I think.
I personally feel like this is not going to go too far. It's just like a hunch I have. And I say that because I believe what's happening here is that they have a cool technology, which is a screen that can be folded and bent and stuff like that. And they take that cool technology and think like, oh, what can we do with this? And the obvious answer is, let's make a foldable phone. But I still don't see what problem that's solving for people. And that's where it will define whether this technology of using foldable screens to make foldable phones is going to last. In my opinion, I don't think this is what we're going to be using in 10 years. And I, of course, this, not this specific device, but this way of using foldable screens. I personally would only want to use, like, let's say Apple comes up with a foldable device. Well, I wouldn't change ecosystems just to use a foldable device, especially not now. So because people always say, oh, when Apple releases a foldable phone, then you're going to want it. Well, of course I will. I'm in the Apple ecosystem. it would take a lot for me to want to change my ecosystem around me, which is basically all my digital life is revolves around Apple stuff. So yeah. It has to be like a huge deal, and foldable screens are not there yet for me. But it would take like Apple to release like a foldable device that's as thin as the iPad Pro and as visually appealing as well for me to actually want a foldable device. And I think we're very, very far from that being a reality.
Right. Yeah, I see that this can go in many different ways. And that's why I mentioned, like, what I'm most excited about here is the screens becoming more dynamic. Because, for example, like, imagine being able to buy an iPad which you could fold out and it would become twice as large. Like, that could be incredible for certain workflows where you could have like way more screen real estate. And if there weren't a lot of compromises, I mean, these devices that have been shown off are obviously like much, much bulkier and thicker and heavier. And, you know, those are characteristics we don't want. But imagine a future where you don't have to have those like really strong trade-offs, but you would instead have something more, you know, portable and easier to use. Another application that I'm thinking of as well is like, how about you were be able to like roll a screen up? Like, that might sound crazy, but imagine like having a huge monitor that you can just roll up and put it like you put it in your jacket, cool. Right? That would be super cool. And again, it's just like, what I'm excited about here is just the fact that we're kind of starting to break this assumption that a screen is always this super sturdy thing that is attached to a device, it's like rock solid, like don't bend it, if you bend it, it breaks, to being more dynamic. And I think that could just open up so many different use cases.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we'll see where it ends. Do you believe this is the future of computing, John?
Well, that's hard to tell. As you know, my dream for the future of computing is to have just one device. And I think this could be at least a stepping stone towards that, where let's say that my iPad and my iPhone would magically be able to become the same device. I mean, if you do the math, that would require it to be like not only folded once, but folded a couple of times. So it'd be almost like a little map that you fold out. But imagine something like that. Like, I would love that. Like, I would love to be able to carry an iPhone in my pocket that when I need to, I can fold it out and I can write an article on it. Like, that would be awesome. So I am excited about it. I'm not sure if it's the future of computing singular, but maybe a stepping stone, maybe something that will inspire us to do something different. But regardless, I'm really, really happy that, you know, these technologies are being shown off and it's making us ask these kind of questions.
Yeah, it's really exciting when something as different comes out and you start wondering what's the future like.
Yeah.
I really like when stuff like this happens. So we'll see. And I really wish I can at least play around with one of those devices sometime.
Yeah, that would be super cool. Maybe we'll see them at like some kind of exhibition or in a store or something in the future. We'll see.
Yeah.
All right. What do you say? Should we round off this episode by doing some hashtag Ask Stacktrace?
Of course. By the way, we haven't been getting too many questions lately. So if you've forgotten, I know we don't do it in every episode, but you can send us questions on Twitter. You can use the hashtag Ask Stacktrace. And we're going to pick some questions and try to answer them in the next episode.
Yeah, absolutely. We do love to answer your questions, and we're going to try to at least fit in like one or two every episode. If we have like a really packed episode with lots of stuff, then we might not do it, but we're going to try to. And so we really appreciate everyone sending in questions, and please do so if you have something that you would like us to talk about or something you'd like to ask us. So this week's question comes from Florian, and Florian wants to hear us talk a little bit more about securing mobile APIs. So he asks us, I got curious about what could be the best way to secure mobile APIs, because hard-coded keys can easily be extracted, and how can I ensure that the endpoint of a mobile API is only accessible from within the mobile app? So basically about app security and how to secure keys like authentication keys or tokens inside of a code base. So Rambo, why don't you tell us about how can you make it possible for someone not to spelunk your tokens and your API keys?
Well, it's basically impossible. Whatever means you use to try and obfuscate your API keys, which you should if you want to at least make it a little bit harder to hack, people are going to be able to extract them. That's like a reality. But there are things you can do. And the thing I am doing with my latest server-side and mobile app communications is I'm using a technology from Apple that answers exactly the question that Florian asked, which is, how can I ensure that the endpoint of a mobile API is only accessed from within the mobile application? Apple has a mechanism for that, which is called device check.
All right, tell us more about that.
So device check is, it's a couple of things. It's an iOS API, but it's also a server-side API from Apple. And the way it works is you ask iOS to generate a device token for you. And then when you make a call to your server, you upload this device token to your server. And from your server, you can call Apple's server and ask them, hey, is this a valid Apple device that has my app installed? And the Apple server is going to say yes or no. And if it's not, you can reject the request. And that's what I'm doing lately. It works. So yeah, I really recommend using device token if you're dealing with API security on iOS. And you will absolutely ensure that the client that's calling your app is an Apple device that has your app installed. It's basically impossible to forge a call. It also makes it difficult to replay calls because the device token has a very short lifespan. So if someone is proxying your network calls and they try to replay a network request like a few seconds later, it's probably not going to go through. I really recommend it.
Nice. That's a really good tip. Another thing that you can do, which is also a bit more cross-platform if you need to also support other platforms than Apple ones, is to use SSL pinning. And SSL pinning is a technique where you basically embed a SSL certificate inside of your application. And usually it's a good idea to not only embed a single one, but multiple ones. And then you also have an equivalent version of that certificate or of those keys on your server. And then what happens is that your request will be signed with that certificate, and your server will then verify that the right certificate is being held by the client that sent that request. So that's another way to kind of also do, you know, a similar approach to what Rambo suggests, which is to make sure that an app is only allowed to talk to this API and no other clients. Like, even if you have the URL and even if you even have like a user token, you won't be able to just request an API endpoint from like a terminal or from some other device.
Yeah, you can also do it like both ways or the other way around.
Belts and suspenders, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and that's something I'm also doing, which is all of the server responses are signed by the server using its private key. And the app will verify the signature using a public key. So it's like SSL, TLS already does that, but in case someone man in the middles and like flips one bit inside the response body, it's going to invalidate the signature and then the app won't recognize the response.
Yeah,
that's useful, especially if you're doing like receipt validation, anything that deals with money or getting some rewards or something like that. By the way, the device check API I mentioned, you can also associate 2 bits of information with a given device, not 2 bytes, 2 bits. So let's say you have like some sort of fraud prevention thing you're doing. You can like set a bit on that device token saying, hey, this is a fraudulent device that we know that's been used for fraud. And that bit will be persisted. And you can query Apple server side API to gather the bit and maybe block that device from calling you.
Cool. I need to look into this API more. It looks super interesting. So, but I think like what you said in the beginning there, which was number one, there is no way to completely foolproof things. That's just impossible. What you're really looking to do is to minimize the possible attack surface. So you're looking to minimize the amount of ways that people can get into your app and get access to your keys. And even if they do get access to 1 or 2 keys, like to make sure they can do the minimum amount of damage. So the low-hanging fruit here really is to make sure that you don't have like string literals with API keys in your app bundle, because all string literals will just be part of the app bundle. They will be loaded into memory and you'll be able to, like, if you can just read that somehow, you're just using something like string dump, you can see that in plain text. So that is step number one. And then increasing your security measures with things like, you know, the checks that Rambo mentioned, with something like SSL pinning, with the key rotation, establishing, you know, key exchange with asymmetrical encryption. You know, there's so many different things you can do, and there's so many different, you know, things you can read up on. But I think the most important thing about app security is to really look at it and create like a little bit of a strategy. Like, how are you planning to defend yourself? And then picking the techniques that you think are the most appropriate for what you're building or for your budget, and also like for, you know, what you're actually trying to secure.
And also use the right level of security depending on the task at hand. Like if you're doing anything that deals with money, of course you need to use really good security, or if it's very sensitive personal data. But if it's just like, oh, I'm sending some events to a server to log them and maybe do some analytics, maybe you don't need super high level security in that example. So yeah. Think about scaling your security accordingly to how secure it needs to be. Not every API call needs to be super extra secure.
Yeah. And also like really taking a look at what you're sending, because sometimes we can accidentally include sensitive information in something like analytics, where mm-hmm. let's say that you are logging that a user viewed a certain screen, and you're logging, you know, for the sake of argument, let's just say you're logging the title of that screen. Well, if that's like something that the user generated, the title could be sensitive information. So number one, you should probably not log that in the first place. But you know, if you need to log something that is user identifiable or could be, especially if the user has inputted it themselves, usually a good idea to secure that.
Yeah, exactly. So I hope this gave Florian and our listeners some ideas as to how to secure their API calls. But I think that's it, right, John?
Yeah, on the topic of security, I also just want to mention that my friend Anastasia Vixantel, she has a lot of really great talks about app security in a very nice, lightweight manner for a lot of them. Like, she does a really, really great job with her slides and explaining things in detail. So we'll put a link in the show notes to a list of her talks about app security.
Yeah, and I'm also going to mention that I'm going to be giving some talks this year and some workshops. and I'm planning on using the theme of privacy and security throughout the year for all my talks and workshops. So
yeah.
Look forward for that.
How not to get spelunked. Yeah, that's going to be a good one.
That's a great title.
Yeah. All right, so that's the end of this week's episode. We'll be back again next week, just like every week from now on, thanks to our really awesome sponsors. And for this episode was made possible thanks to Mac Stadium. So please do check them out at macstadium.com/stacktrace. But most importantly, thank you so much for listening, everybody. Means so much to us to have so many people listening to the show, to get your feedback and your questions and things like that. So please keep it coming and stay tuned for more episodes. In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter. I am at John Sundell. And you can find Mr. Rambo at @_inside on Twitter. But that's it for this week. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.